It's Wednesday, February 23rd, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Voters in Chicago spoke decisively on Tuesday as they elected former U.S. Congressman and former White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel as the city's next mayor. Now, this is going to be a big change for the city of Chicago, but the exact contours of that change are anything but yet clear. For the better part of the last several decades, the city of Chicago has been presided over by a member of the Daley family. Now, a very different political dynasty is taking shape in one of the nation's largest cities, and Rahm Emanuel, known for his bare-knuckle Democratic politics, is going to be the city's new mayor. Now, one of the interesting things about this race is that, indeed, Mr. Emanuel began his race by resigning as the White House Chief of Staff and relocating back to Chicago, where he immediately faced challenges to his residency status. There were different twists and turns in this election, but in the end, with 55% of the vote, Mr. Emanuel has prevailed on the first ballot. Now, as we look at this particular situation, we're reminded of the fact that, as the former Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, said famously, all politics is local, and perhaps there is no local politics more powerful than that of a major city mayoralty. In this case, the city of Chicago is basically ruled over by its mayor. That does have to work with a city council, after all. But it reminds us that cities really are important. Municipalities, and especially the large urban and metropolitan cities of the nation, really are political powerhouses. This would explain why a White House Chief of Staff and a former U.S. Congressman might decide to put his name and reputation and indeed his political career on the line to run for a race that at first appeared to be something like a long shot. But it appears that now mayor-to-be Rahm Emanuel and the city of Chicago just might, well, deserve each other. We'll see what he does when he bears this kind of executive responsibility for the very first time. The big story in the international scene is undoubtedly Libya, where the strongman there, Muammar Gaddafi, who's been holding on to power for over 40 years, now is demonstrating a sense of almost manic intensity and determination to remain in office. Now, when you look at Mr. Gaddafi, you're looking at a man who at various times in his long and rather infamous career has demonstrated something less than rationality. That's putting it kindly. His behavior has often been bizarre, his language almost incomprehensible. And now he is threatening his own people. After first trotting out his firstborn son to offer threats against demonstrators on the streets of Tripoli and other Libyan cities, Mr. Gaddafi himself, now posing as a martyr for his nation, declares that there is no way that he will voluntarily leave office. Now, that may be the case, because one of the things that is becoming clear in Libya is that the big question has to do with the disposition of the military. In Egypt and in Tunisia, the military refused, on any large scale, to fire on its own young people, the youth of the nation. Now, that's a very different story when we come to Libya, where the situation is incredibly messy. The Libyan second-in-command has now gone into exile, and, telling you something of the split in the Libyan military, two of its military jets landed on the island of Malta, where the pilots asked for political asylum. We're watching the very last days, in all likelihood, of a notoriously evil regime. But one of the things Christians must ponder in considering the nation of Libya is just how it comes to pass that a person who is so irrational, so seemingly unattractive in political terms, so threatening not only to the nations around him and to world peace, but to his own people, could cling to office for so long. I think it tells us something about the primal human urge for order and discipline, even before the desire to be free and to have something like the democratic liberties that Americans and most Europeans enjoy. When it comes to the basic needs the human beings demonstrate, a need for order and security appears to be higher on the list of the hierarchy of those goods than does even freedom and liberty. But freedom and liberty do not appear to be submerged for long. In the grand scheme of history, even 40 years is not that long a period of time when you're considering the fact that a nation like Libya is just now making its way into the modern age. The modern age, it seems, fuels a great desire for the kind of democratic liberties that Americans pioneered in holding forth before the world. What will happen in Libya? Only time will tell. We need to pray for the peace of that nation. We need to pray that its people will come to know true liberty and freedom. And we need to pray that the transition there will not be violent. And Christians need to be praying also that whatever happens there will represent an opening for the gospel of Jesus Christ. The big political story in the United States, of course, is focused on the state of Wisconsin, where newly elected Governor Scott Walker is holding forth in a fight against Democratic legislators who are in the minority, who have taken themselves across the state line so that they cannot be required to vote, thus robbing Mr. Walker and the Republican majority of a quorum. But he's also facing down, in a larger sense, the public sector unions, and in an even larger sense than that, the union movement itself. When Christians consider this, we need to keep in mind that what's really at stake in the state of Wisconsin is who controls the state, who controls the government. The public sector unions are one of the major threats to American democracy, because after all, they represent a collective action over against the people. One of the most dangerous trends in terms of democratic governments is when you see the government begin to become one of the major employers. Now, coast to coast, that's now a very sad and ominous reality. But in certain states, the situation is even worse than the general picture nationwide. In Wisconsin, the public sector unions were given, only in fairly recent years, collective bargaining power. This basically gives these labor unions, who after all are organized against the taxpaying citizens for their collective bargaining, the right to hold the state hostage. And in these difficult economic times, it has become clear that not only Wisconsin, but most other states can ill afford to pay the kinds of benefits and salaries that these public sector unions have arranged and demanded. When Christians think about the situation in Wisconsin, we need to remember that there really was a time when labor unions were an important part of leveling the field. You go back to the early 20th century and the power of the robber barons. You go back to the rise of the industrial age in America, and you come to understand that that kind of political power, unchecked by the labor unions of the early 20th century, led to abuses that none of us would endorse. But the right to collectively bargain through a labor union in private industry is quite a different thing than the right to face off the voters and the taxpaying citizens of a state by collective bargaining on the part of public sector unions. But the unions themselves are working their way out of a job. A small minority of workers in America are now part of unions, and the only growth that is really coming in terms of union membership is in the public sector unions. And so what was necessary in the early 20th century in order to protect the rights of workers is now a political force that appears, if anything, to be toxic to the very idea of employment and to the flourishing of business and a healthy economy. It's hard to tell exactly what will happen in Wisconsin. Governor Walker appears to be standing firm, and at least the people of his state appear to be losing sympathy for the unionized workers who are protesting, and as you look at the protests, are actually calling together a rather motley crew of different leftist political groups that aren't likely to be endearing to the citizens of Wisconsin. But we'll see. Strange political seasons have emerged from conflicts such as these, and when it comes to staring down the public sector unions, it's not just this Republican governor, but also Democratic governors such as the newly elected governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo. If Governors Cuomo and Walker are not able to face down their public sector unions, there is no hope for a rescue from their economic crises, especially when it comes to gaining control of their state's budgets. We'll be watching all of these stories with great interest. Every once in a while, you see a news story that leads you to scratch your head and wonder how such a thing could come to pass. Paul Sullivan, writing in the personal business section of the New York Times over the weekend, wrote an article entitled, How Families Avoid Scandal When Any Slip Can Go Viral. It's in the Wealth Matters column, which is always interesting, and in this case, Mr. Sullivan is writing about a seminar that brought together several consultants to advise extremely wealthy families about how they can protect their family's good name and reputation in the internet age and the age of almost immediate media swarm. Now, the most amazing thing about this is that the advice could hardly seem to be rare enough or even expert enough to require some kind of specialized seminar with consultants and speakers brought in to give advice. For instance, this is the most fundamental advice they gave. Avoid any behavior that will lead to scandal. You needed a seminar for that? The reality is that this article underlines the fact that even in our morally confused age, reputations still matter. The background to this story is the fact that many of these wealthy families discovered that their economic, social, cultural, and political clout can be minimized and greatly damaged by the bad behavior of their family members. Now, this was a very interesting seminar, I'm sure. But it appears to be the kind of seminar that is necessary for people who have lost all moral sense in the first place and need to bring in consultants how to tell them how to stay out of trouble. Then again, maybe a good many of us could use a seminar such as this to remind us what our fathers told us in ages past, and that is that we are to live worthy of our name. Finally, when it comes to the empirical verification of human sinfulness, news articles such as this one serve as ample evidence. Ian Lovett, writing in the New York Times, writes an article entitled Condom Requirements Sought for Sex Film Sets. Los Angeles is the location where many of the nation's pornographic films are actually shot and produced. And it turns out that the sex film industry there, as we've reported previously, has a sex clinic in order to prove, or at least to document, the lack of infection on the part of the actors in pornographic films. But the city of Los Angeles has decided that this just isn't going far enough and is to require the use of condoms in the making of pornographic films. Why talk about this? Because it just reminds us in a very important and emphatic way of the way human sinfulness works. We not only plot to sin, we not only orchestrate a way to profit from that sin, but we also come up with ways in which we try to mitigate its ill effects. In this case, what you have is an industry that is being forced, even against its will, to protect the health of its own employees, if that's the right word to use for them, by requiring the use of a condom as if that's going to solve the problem. Missing from this is, of course, the larger issue right before us as you consider the headline to this news article, that this is a business that itself is one that is deeply, deeply sick, evil, and without any doubt at all, unsafe. There's no way to make sin safe. But this news article reminds us that human beings, left to our own devices, will even fool ourselves into thinking that we can make sin safe. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You'll also be able to follow me at Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller for updates during the day. For more information about Southern Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.